I want to begin by thanking John and Janet Martin for purchasing this sermon at last year's service auction. These services are always a challenge for a minister. Some purchasers like to play Stump the Preacher. Often the topics are provocative and require a great deal of thought. Over several meetings and exchanges, we try to create a meaningful sermon. Some purchasers are extremely precise, telling me what to be read and giving me explicit details. Others enjoy offering a bit of vagueness. I like the vagueness because it gives me more license to explore further and to go out in different directions. Often it will be a sermon about a topic that somebody is wrestling with themselves, and they figure, I think I'll have the preacher wrestle with this one and take care of doing work, and then I can know what to think, or at least I can know what I disagree with. Sometimes it can be based on a question. One of my favorites through the years was, are there atheists in foxholes? And I think that has to be one of the favorites because I still remember it 20 years later. Now, when I learned that John and Janet purchased the sermon, I called them and set up a meeting to go over and speak. At our initial meeting, John came out with a book that was filled with slips of paper and very pithy sayings. John went on to say that he was interested in how things change as we look at them, in addition to the way that they change over time. In a later meeting, he shared an anecdote in which Mark Twain poured a glass of water and marveled at how it might look like a glass of whiskey, even though it's not a glass of whiskey. He also spoke about ways in which evidence and proof could be ways of playing games with our minds as we continue to explore how they change over time. I realized, as he continued to speak about it, that one of the things that he was describing was how our perspectives change over time. How, as we look at something from different angles, and I shared the example of my good friend, Roy Attitude of Gratitude, who owns a Picasso. And I asked him, well, what's it look like? And he said, all these different angles, and you have to look at it different ways. And that's what it's changing in perspective means, that as time goes on, we see things different. Different minutiae can be revealed to us. And so, as I thought more about it, I came up with the title, A Matter of Perspective. Now, while I was waiting for that glass of water to turn into whiskey, I thought about the field of hermeneutics. In philosophy, hermeneutics is the study of interpretations. In essence, how we look at something and how we interpret it. Now, all of us may experience the same event, but when we watch it and then it registers in our minds, we may come up with different memories of it. Just what really happened? Now, aside from sensory stimuli, which cause pleasure or pain, it might be the case that there are no pure experiences. Every experience is mediated by our perspective, by the way that we look at it, our expectations of what's happening, what we believe is happening, what we can't believe is actually happening. And even pleasure or pain can be mediated through these contexts, our perspectives. I'll give you an example of, I enjoy going in and getting a good deep tissue massage. However, when the masseur or masseuse is inflicting very incredible severe pain as they go deep into the stressed out muscles, it hurts like hell. But I know that the perspective is it's going to feel much better later. I expect that there are some people who go in and enjoy that, you know, while it's happening. They don't worry about what's going to happen later. They just enjoy that pain. They're called the masochists. The point that I want to make is that all of our experiences are mediated through our thoughts, through our various sensory organs, through our understandings. That's why two people may experience a similar event, and then the two of them could come up with two very different understandings of what really happened, what they saw, what they heard. This has been the case in some of the shootings, where people have looked at it, and one witness says one thing, another witness says something else. And you know, even when the cameras show, people were, did it really happen that way? Yep. As Unitarian Universalists, most of us express a fondness for reading. David Tracy, who is a theologian, tells us that a classic book is one that rewards you with different insights and understandings as you read it at various stages of your life. And that's why a classic is something that you not only take out from the library, but very often you want to buy and own so that you can mark up your own copy of it. Some of you may be aware of the Great Books Program that was started at the University of Chicago by Mortimer J. Evo. They have what's called a basic program, which has a core of books that are read over a four-year span. And it's been pretty much the same way for, I think, at least 50 or 60 years. Although the list of books is biased toward dead white Western men, it is a good starting point. When my first wife and I started taking the program, one of the women in our group was Gladys, who was a legal secretary. And Gladys had been taking the program for more than 40 years at that stage. And I expect if Gladys is still alive and capable of reading, Gladys is probably still taking the program. She would read, she'd go to the classes, and the different instructors, because it's a program that takes place all over the metropolitan area of Chicago, so it'll happen in different neighborhoods. We got into a group that was downtown in the Loop, because it meant that people from all over came for it. And Gladys was in our first group. And she told us that even after those 40 years, she still enjoyed finding new insights in some of those books. Now, the books themselves did not change, but the woman who started reading them as somebody fresh out of college and a young legal secretary changed during those years. And when her life experiences were combined with the new insights that she was gaining, you could see how she was able to pick up new things in the book. And that's why we call them classics. One of my father's brothers, was a medic on an aircraft carrier in the Pacific during the Second World War. He endured direct hits by kamikaze pilots and tended to the burns and sundry other wounds that the sailors had to deal with. When I mentioned my concern about the U.S. introducing atomic weapons at the end of the Second World War, he very graciously disagreed with me, and he told me that I owe my life to those bombs, because at the time they were dropped, we were preparing for a land invasion of Japan, and you can only imagine how many people, both soldiers as well as civilians, would have been killed if the Allies had to go through a land invasion of Japan. Furthermore, even on the aircraft carrier, at sea we were worrying about the kamikazes. If we had been in close to Japan itself, it would have been, far riskier. Now, as a post-war child, comfortable with everything from Japanese transistor radios, where they were still made in Japan, and Japanese cars as an adult, I knew that we were in two different places when we spoke about nuclear weapons and what happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I expect that he cringed when he rode in his son's Lexus, just as my father was outraged when my brother went through a series of Audi, BMW, and Mercedes. For him, as a Jew, for his son to be buying German cars was anathema. Now, a second cousin of ours married an Israeli ambassador. Before her husband retired, they had made their way from Brazil to Mexico. All three of their children served in the Israeli Defense Forces, and all three of them experienced battles firsthand. When I was sitting next to my cousin at a family reunion, the discussion came around to peace in the Middle East. And her response was, "You don't understand what it's like living in our neighborhood." And as a mother, she spoke of enduring the word when her children went off to war. She worried about listening to stories of suicide bombers blowing themselves up in the pizzerias and the coffee shops that her children frequented, along with other young Israelis. And like my uncle, I expect that she looked at me as what ministers sometimes refer to as bluebirds, people who are very innocent. William Blake had the Songs of Innocence and Experience, and the bluebird is somebody who is innocent and hasn't experienced profound human evil. And again, it comes back to a matter of perspective. If we had been born in a Japanese family, or a German family, or a Palestinian family, our perspectives would have been different. Now, one of the points that John made in our discussions was the way that perspectives change. And for me, there's something very Unitarian Universalist in this. Remember, more than 80% of us were not born into the faith, as they say. We're come-inners. We were born with some other religious background. And then at some stage in our lives, we made the conscious decision to come into this religious community, to walk through the doors, not only physically, but with our identities, to see the world through Unitarian Universalist eyes, rather than Jewish eyes, Lutheran eyes, Baptist eyes, Catholic eyes, Hindu or Buddhist eyes. Well, I guess we do have some Buddhists around. Who have dual citizenship, and we have others who have dual citizenship. But the important thing is, as Unitarian Universalists, we look at things through the lens of our religious perspective. And I think that every one of us could sit down and tell that story. In fact, it might be an interesting series of sermons for you to engage in the next year. How I became a Unitarian Universalist. Sometimes we call it witnessing. But the main thing is, it's sharing our perspective and how we came to this place. For me, it was learning about the Holocaust. After seeing pictures of innocent children being led to slaughter, I began asking questions. Soon I began asking why the God I had grown up believing in with all my heart and absolute trust had been such a betrayer. how that God had allowed such cruelty to be perpetrated upon his so-called chosen children. Now, learning that God was not all-powerful led me to question the entire idea of God. And I expect that my adult self might have handled this differently, but I was about 8 years old at the time. And so for me, that God blew it, as far as I was concerned. Gay and lesbian Christians have shared similar stories with me. The ways in which they heard stories, sermons, that denigrated them, that made them ashamed of who they were. They knew that the God that was being preached in those congregations was not a God that they could worship. And so they left. And we welcome them here. Because a God that would persecute people for the way that they're born is not a God that any of us should believe in. Eventually, they began to see the world from Unitarian Universal sides, saw what was beautiful and individual and hopeful in themselves, and left the old God behind. Now, we are back to that question of perspectives again. Is it fair to ask, did God really change? Or was it our change in perspective and how we were treated and our self-identities as believers changed? We began to see the world through Unitarian Universalist eyes. In a book on Viktor Frankl, of whom I will have more to say next month, his major American interpreter, Unitarian Universalist Joseph Aubrey, writes, and I'm changing this to use inclusive language, which I believe that both Frankl and Fabry would have done if they were still alive. According to Frankl, people have the capacity to see through their subjective perspective and perceive the objective reality behind it. People look at the world not as through a kaleidoscope, but as through a telescope. Frankl explains the difference as follows. In a kaleidoscope, people see only what we have put in, and the pattern depends on how we turn the kaleidoscope. But when a person looks through a telescope, he or she looks beyond their subjective perspective. He or she looks at the objective world. And that is exactly the meaning of perspective. Perspicere means to look through. Now, as much as I admire Frankl, I'm not totally sure that I agree completely with Fabry. While it may be ideal to look through a telescope, looking directly at something and having that magnified, it's not always possible. And as I said earlier, when it came to witnesses of an event, there's something of our own minds, of our own experiences, that's twisting the kaleidoscope a bit. In other words, the preponderance of evidence that we're prepared to accept leads us to one conclusion or another. And again, we're back to the importance of perspective. It goes to how we look at the world, how we see it, how we tune the telescope even. Somewhere in the turning of the kaleidoscope or the telescope, we fixate, our mind and our eyes become fixed on what we believe we are seeing, what is most sharp, the sharpest view for us. And we accept that as our working idea of the truth. Now let me go back to the interchange with my Israeli cousin. When she married her husband and eventually moved to Israel, she began seeing the world through Israeli eyes, rather than the Jersey girl that she had been growing up. The unsafe neighborhood of which she spoke was no longer Central Jersey. It wasn't even North America. It was the battle zone that she was living in. And I will add that our discussion took place nearly 20 years ago. While it was after the first attack on the World Trade Towers, it was before 9/11. And after 9/11, our nation became more experienced when it came to the idea of battles, of warfare, of attacks taking place on our continent. Remember, it hadn't really been since the Civil War that America had been under attack on our turf. After a discussion, I remember thinking about how the two of us were seeing the world through these two different perspectives. While I still identify with my Jewish background, I see the world more through Unitarian Universalist eyes. Yes, I'm still a strong supporter of Israel and believe that they need to defend themselves against the Arab attackers. However, after years of watching failed attempts at peace that have been stonewalled, particularly because of the role of settlers and this desire for a greater Israel that's going to incorporate the land that will eventually, hopefully, go to the Palestinians, I've begun to see in a different light, through different eyes. And I will stress, this is not something that happened immediately. It didn't. In 1975, when I became a Unitarian Universalist, I still saw the world much more through Jewish eyes than when it came to the Middle East. And it didn't really change completely in 1982, when I settled in my first parish, and that summer, the Christian phalangists in Lebanon butchered Palestinian refugees in Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. It was only later, after observing the multiple attempts at peace that were being obfuscated, that I realized that I had to speak from the different perspective that I had embraced. Ask yourselves, in what ways do you now see the world through different eyes than you did before you came into this building, before you came into Unitarian Universalism? Now, earlier I mentioned philosophers and the field of hermeneutics, the study of interpretations. One of the most important changes in Christianity took place during the early 19th century when the German higher criticism came into being. These were German biblical scholars who began to ask, let's not just take these biblical stories at face value. We need to ask, where they were written? What was happening in the world when they were written? One of the first questions that they asked was, who was the target audience? Who were these writers writing for? It's been said that Matthew was writing for a Jewish audience. That's why you have all the begats at the beginning of Matthew, where he's trying to establish Jesus' Jewish pedigree. Mark and Luke were not as concerned with Jesus' Jewish background. This was not a pertinent concern for them. Their attempt was to make this more accessible to the non-Jews, the Gentiles. Just like Paul, who was writing that, although he had been Jewish and had persecuted Christians, after his experience on the road to Damascus, he changed and began to see the need to speak differently and to write for a different audience. The idea that the Germans were asking these questions was anathema to most Christians, particularly in the English-speaking world. But most of the early American Unitarians embraced it. In fact, many of them learned German so that they could read these scholarly works in their original. And again, it gave them a new perspective, a new way of looking at the Bible, and ultimately a new way of looking at religion, one that would be based on a scholarly tradition rather than accepting everything at face value. As you prepare to embark upon a period of being lay-led, you may find it heartening to know that in the years after the Second World War, one of the new perspectives in Unitarianism, it was before merger, was what was known as the fellowship movement. These were lay-led congregations that often started meeting in someone's living room. The problem was, it was because there was a shortage of ministers at that time. And the problem was, some of them never grew out of the living room. And once the people who were just hanging around the living room got tired of it, there was nothing there in terms of a structure to move on to. And so the mortality rate of fellowships was somewhere around 50%. I once served a congregation that had its origins in a psychiatrist's waiting room. I think that the psychiatrist began recruiting his patients for the congregation. And then he still held memories of him. In fact, the church library was named for him. Some of those members were behaving as though they were still in the psychiatrist's waiting room. And that was a challenge with that church. But others eventually moved beyond that, and new people came in and gave it new blood. Hermeneutics asked the question, what does this mean to me? How does this text speak to me and my ultimate concerns? What's the question underneath the question? What's the most important and effective and meaningful way of interpreting this experience? If you begin by examining and then understanding your perspective, you will have made great strides. The people who started the fellowships, as I said, 50% of them, the congregations died out. But the other half, in many cases, went on to healthy life. Some of them changed their name from fellowship to church. Others still held on to the name fellowship because they didn't like the term church. And they became, in some cases, very strong congregations. And you have that opportunity. And I would encourage you to use that time as a lay-led group to further get a sense of who you are as a community so that you can build and bring that perspective to the next student who comes here. When you understand your own perspective, you are able to look at the world and to say, this is who I am, this is how I see the world. And there's certainty in that. At the very least, you'll be able to see your differences. And that's a very Unitarian Universalist attitude and idea. It's a tangible way of respecting the inherent worth and dignity of every person while maintaining the integrity of our individual, responsible searches for truth and meaning. And that's something worth holding a glass of water up to with a toast, even if it does not turn to whiskey. Well, thank you, John and Janet, by honoring me to, asking me to preach on this topic. In essence, giving me the time to address this very profound issue.